Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for argument today is Smith v. Grams. And Mr. O'Brien, are you there?
I am, Your Honor. Can you hear me loud and clear?
Mr. Soy, I was going to do it when your case is called, but we can do it now.
Okay, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. O'Brien, if you're ready, Ms. Hanley.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. This case involves both a jurisdictional question and a substantive question. Turning first to the jurisdictional question, this Court has jurisdiction over this matter because, as explained in the briefs, Mr. Smith's April 2nd Notice of Appeal satisfied the standards set forth in Smith v. Berry. The April 2nd Notice of Appeal was filed within 30 days and provided the State with notice of Mr. Smith's intent to appeal the District Court's denial of habeas relief. Further, as the State knew, Mr. Smith could only appeal to this Court. Therefore, the April 2nd notice constituted notice of appeal. I'm happy to answer any questions on jurisdiction, but at this time I'd like to turn to the substantive issue.
Well, I do have a couple questions. Your client had some problems in the Seventh Circuit on other cases. He wasn't happy about coming to this Court, was he?
Your Honor, the other cases aren't really part of the record on this appeal. What the client's intent was at the time he filed his April 2nd notice of appeal under Smith v. Berry isn't really the determinative factor.
Well, couldn't that notice have been some effort to try to find a way around this Court, to some sort of strategy to get directly to the Supreme Court to avoid this Court?
Well, based on the record, it's unclear what the thought process was behind the April 2nd notice of appeal. But under Smith v. Berry, the standard is what notice did the state have? And at the time that Mr. Smith filed his notice of appeal on April 2nd, the only court he could have appealed to was this court. And as this court held in Ortiz v. Butler, when under the circumstances of the case, this court is the only court to which appeal may be taken, and the state is not prejudiced by Mr. Smith's failure to designate the appropriate court, then the notice may be treated as a functional equivalent of the notice of appeal.
So that really reads out of the rule the requirement that the court to which the appeal is to be taken has to be in the notice. If he can just say notice of appeal, it doesn't matter what court he states.
Well, it depends on the circumstances of the case. But in this case, it was clear that there was only one court to which appeal could be taken. Just as in Ortiz v. Butler, there was only one court to which appeal could be taken. And the state would have known that.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Turning to the substantive question, Petitioner Appellant James Smith was denied his Sixth Amendment right to counsel at trial by the trial court, which conditioned the withdrawal of Mr. Smith's existing counsel on the appointment of replacement counsel and then refused to provide Mr. Smith with counsel. As a result, he was forced to represent himself at trial and ultimately was convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison.
Do you believe that the trial judge was without any authority to make sure that counsel was provided?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well,
without authority?
He said, it's out of my hands, it's a public defender. If they're not going to provide anybody, you're out of luck.
Well, that's a question of state law. Actually, under Wisconsin state law, he did have authority to appoint an attorney to Mr. Smith. And we cited that in the opening brief. I believe the case is State v. Dean, and I can get more information on that.
Well, no, that was my question to you, and you say he does have the authority.
Yes, as set forth in the opening brief, under State v. Dean, under Wisconsin law, the trial court had the authority and the discretion to appoint Mr. Smith counsel regardless of the public defender's policy. Now, Mr. Smith's loss of counsel was a result of confusion by both the trial court and the public defender's office. For example, the trial court seemed to be under the impression that it couldn't appoint counsel, and it could, and the trial court seemed to be unaware of the public defender's policy limiting attorney appointments. Likewise, the public defender failed to deliver to Mr. Smith the letter setting forth its policy. It mailed it to his house when the public defender knew that Mr. Smith was in jail. Attorney Wilmoth, Mr. Smith's existing attorney, also knew that Mr. Smith was in jail and never delivered him this letter. So under the facts of this case, Mr. Smith's purported waiver of the right to counsel cannot be deemed knowing and intelligent as required by the Supreme Court precedent. Indeed, given several key facts, Mr. Smith's decision to discharge Attorney Wilmoth at the May 4th hearing was not a waiver of counsel. First, when Attorney Wilmoth filed his motion to withdraw at that hearing, he confirmed that he had informed the public defender's office that they'd have to appoint a new attorney, and they stated that they, quote, had a mind to do so. The trial court likewise granted Attorney Wilmoth's motion to withdraw.
Was Mr. Wilmoth, he was a private attorney who had been recruited by the public defender, or was he someone on the staff of the public defender?
It's not clear from the record, but he had been, in one way or another, he had been appointed by the public defender's office.
I'm wondering if he has any authority to make that kind of representation to the public defender's office.
Well, whether or not he had the authority, the information that was presented to Mr. Smith at the May 4th hearing, you know, Mr. Smith wouldn't have known if Attorney Wilmoth had that authority. But Mr. Smith, standing there, heard Attorney Wilmoth say that the public defender's office was going to appoint him another attorney. He heard the trial court say, I'm granting the motion to withdraw, quote, on the condition that the public defender's office be notified that a new attorney be appointed, quote, as quickly as possible. Mr. Smith hadn't received a copy of the public defender's office, which purportedly stated that it limited appointments. And Mr. Smith stated that as of the May 4th hearing, he had talked to Attorney Marola and believed that Attorney Marola would be ready to represent him. So at the time Mr. Smith agreed to Attorney Wilmoth's discharge at that May 4th hearing, he was under the belief that he was going to be appointed another attorney. In fact, at the May 10th hearing, not only was Mr. Smith surprised that he didn't have counsel, but the trial court was surprised that he didn't have counsel. The trial court actually had to call the public defender's office and try to clarify what the policy was. The public defender's office thought they'd already given him three attorneys when, in fact, they'd only given Mr. Smith two attorneys.
What if he had actually obtained another attorney and then decided he didn't want him either?
Well, the Constitution doesn't guarantee Mr. Smith unlimited attorneys. But what it does require is at the time he makes his decision to terminate counsel, he understands that this is it, that this is the only attorney he's getting. In fact, the trial court could have limited him to one attorney. But at the time that Mr. Smith then makes the decision to terminate his existing counsel, he has to know what his choice is. In fact, this court held in United States v. ORI that you can waive counsel by terminating the counsel that you have when you know that this is your only option is between this counsel and representing yourself. But this quote said, provided, quote, the offer is clear. And in this case, Mr. Smith hadn't been given a clear offer. And likewise, the court hadn't addressed the dangers and disadvantages of self-representation or otherwise followed the rigorous restrictions that the Supreme Court requires be followed before somebody can be deemed to have waived their right to counsel.
Didn't your client want just one lawyer, though? Didn't he just want Marola, or if he couldn't get Marola, he was going to represent himself?
He stated a strong preference for Marola. However, at both the May 4th and the May 10th hearing, he stated that he wanted Marola, but he didn't make it conditional on that. In fact, he said, I want an attorney. And he asked at the May 10th proceeding and the May 31st, he wanted any attorney. He wanted standby counsel. He didn't want to be alone.
And simultaneously, he insisted on the speedy trial. He would not back off that.
Well, at the time that the speedy trial issue came up at the May 31st proceeding, the court had already informed Mr. Smith unequivocally that it would not appoint Mr. Smith counsel. It stated it could not appoint Mr. Smith counsel. It also confirmed with the public defender's office that it would not appoint Mr. Smith standby counsel or full counsel. So the court essentially offered Mr. Smith a Hobson's choice. Proceed to trial without counsel right now, or waive your right to speedy trial so we can get you counsel, but we're not going to get you counsel.
But didn't Smith do the same thing to the judge, say, I want an attorney right now and I want a trial right now?
Well,
wouldn't even give the judge the time to find him an attorney.
But as of the May 31st proceeding, the trial court had informed Mr. Smith that he wouldn't get any counsel at all. So it's a bit of a red herring to ask someone to waive one right for another right when they've already been told they're not getting that right. And I've entered my rebuttal time, so I'll reserve the remainder.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Brien?
May it please the court, I trust that you can hear me.
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. And first of all, I want to express my appreciation for allowing me to appear by phone. It's a great convenience. Thank you. May it please the court, I will address I will try to address both issues. I'll start with the second issue first because of the concerns about what happened here. And I would like to direct this court's attention to the May 25th hearing, which I think is really telling to what Mr. Smith really intended to do here. That was the original scheduled trial date, and that was the date. It's a very brief hearing. It appears in the separate appendix of the petitioner at 41 through 44, and there Mr. Smith appears pro se on the what was the scheduled trial date and was ready to go. He announced himself ready to go, and then the trial judge Mannion said, well, I can't hear the case, but since you have a speedy trial demand, we'll try to find another one. And they checked with Judge Wagner, who was not available that day. However, they could adjourn it for 6 days, and it would still be within the speedy trial limits under the Wisconsin statute. Mr. Smith, when told that we're going to have to adjourn your trial, immediately objected and invoked his speedy trial right. He was appearing pro se at that time. He said, I want to go to trial now. He did not say at the May 25th hearing, I want a lawyer. When you couple that May 25th hearing with the March 23rd hearing where he said, I don't want a public defender. I want to represent myself. I can represent myself. And if you're going to insist on me having a lawyer, I will only accept Attorney Marola, who represented me before. But if I can't have Marola, then I will represent myself. So I think his conduct has been consistent. Was there some confusion about the number of lawyers he had? Was there some uncertainty as to what the public defender would do? Yes. However, Mr. Smith's intent and his conduct is pretty consistent throughout. He fired two lawyers. The courts jealously guarded his right to appointed counsel.
Counsel, do you agree that the judge had authority apart from the public defender to appoint counsel for him?
Yes, I believe State v. Dean does hold that. I think the judge was mistaken at that time. I think the practice was generally to send these cases to the public defender because they would make indigency determinations. It basically took a lot of this out of the hands of the court, but the court still had discretion. However, subsequent Wisconsin case law, I discussed this at footnote 4 of our brief, does not require the court to advise the defendant that he has a broader right than the right to appointed counsel by the state public defender. And I think it's pretty clear that it's sort of a moot point here, because if you look at the judge's comments throughout these proceedings, at least Judge Mannion's comments, I think it's pretty clear that had he been asked, Your Honor, even though the public defender won't appoint me a third one, will you? I think it's pretty clear he would have rejected that. But I also think it's a moot point because as of May 25th, I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Smith was ready to go by himself. Frankly, he had no right to a third attorney because there's nothing in this record to indicate that he had valid reasons for firing these two.
The judge could have also appointed standby counsel.
He could have. The public defender rejected appointing standby counsel. They looked into it. The judge could have. But I think it's you have to look at this in the context. Mr. Wilmoth was willing to represent Mr. Smith. There's nothing to indicate that Wilmoth would have been unwilling to represent him in standby capacity. We don't know exactly what the nature of their conversations were, but I think it's pretty clear Wilmoth, if asked, would have represented him. But Mr. Smith wanted Attorney Marola, and I don't think that position ever changed in his mind.
Judge Ripple asked a question earlier about whether these attorneys were employed by the public defender or were they drawn from the private bar. Do you know?
I don't know for certain. It's my belief that they were from the private bar, but I am not. I can't answer that question for certain.
Thank
Sorry.
You.
I think we have to understand the state courts did protect Mr. Smith's right to appointed counsel to represent him not once but twice, and then they respected his unequivocal insistence on the right to represent himself, which was expressed so clearly at the March 23rd hearing, and therefore reasonably applied the principles of Beretta v. California. And as reflected in the May 25th hearing, his position really hadn't changed. His position would have changed if someone had appointed Attorney Marola, but he had no constitutional right to have counsel of his choice.
Well, Mr. O'Brien, I understand you're saying that he firmly asserted his interest in proceeding pro se, but what about the judge's advice to him about the hazards of that? Can you address that?
no specific colloquy. However, there were two different colloquies, once at the March 23rd and the other at the, I believe it was the May 10th hearing, discussing his background, his education, things of that nature. And I'd also point out that I do not believe it's a talismanic thing, that you have to have this, what I think it's called a Feretta colloquy, in order to have a valid waiver. Again, you look at whether he, in fact, voluntarily and intelligently waived his right to counsel by nature of his conduct. And I think this record is clear enough to show you he, and the record shows he had been through another armed robbery trial quite recently, and there he was represented by Attorney Marola. He was an experienced criminal defendant. He knew the law. He knew the penalties for armed robbery, having just been through another armed robbery trial. He knew the seriousness of the trial. He was specifically advised by Judge Mannion that this was a very serious offense. So we don't have the crystal clear, clean waiver colloquy that we prefer, but overall, this record, I think, shows an understanding of the dangers of self-representation. Somewhat knowledge of the law. Mr. Smith insisted that he was ready to go, that he knew the law, he'd been around the block, he had assistance from other inmates. So I believe this record is clear enough to show, at least circumstantially, a sufficient waiver. If I could briefly speak to the jurisdictional issue, since I think we're coming up close, this is an unusual case in that while Smith v. Berry says, you know, when it's unclear, you don't look at the actual intent. You look at the notice that was given. The notice in the April 2nd notice of appeal was clearly that he was trying to go to the United States Supreme Court. What's unusual, that standing by itself might not be enough to void his notice of appeal, that someone could say, oh, he meant to go to the Seventh Circuit. What's different here is that we know what Mr. Smith's actual intent was. His actual intent was twofold. Number one, not to appeal to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And number two, he mistakenly appealed to the United States Supreme Court when he said in his filing in this court in June of 2008 that he really intended to file in the Wisconsin Supreme Court in order to raise an American with Disabilities Act claim regarding counsel on appeal in the state court proceedings. So it's unusual in that I don't think Smith v. Berry cut out an expression of actual intent, an actual intent to bypass the federal appellate court, and an actual intent to go to another court that is consistent with what's stated in the notice of appeal, which is clearly not to come to the Seventh Circuit. And then that's not cured, I believe, by the Rule 52 certification filed on April 20th, which is 35 pages long and nowhere mentions the district court's order whatsoever, and lays out in great detail his claim under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So I think we do have a legitimate threshold jurisdictional claim that the state really didn't know what Mr. Smith was trying to do, but one thing is clear, he was not trying to come into this court. And he knew exactly how to do it because he did it on June 4th in perfect fashion, although untimely, and he knew exactly how to do it because he had done it several times in the 4 years preceding his appeal in this case. I believe that this court did not even reach the second issue. However, we would also suggest on the second issue that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, the district court was correct in holding the Wisconsin Court of Appeals did not act contrary to Feretta v. California or cases such as Illinois v. Allen that says you can waive rights by your conduct and did not make an unreasonable determination in light of the facts presented. While one could debate whether more was required, this was not an unreasonable determination to say that Mr. Smith, in fact, waived by his conduct his right to counsel and, in fact, exercised by his conduct his right to represent himself. So if there are no further questions, I guess I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Ms. Hanley? You have 1 minute, Ms. Hanley.
Okay, I'd like to briefly respond to Mr. O'Brien's comments regarding the May 25th hearing. Now, the May 25th hearing took place after the May 10th hearing. So As Mr. Smith was standing at the May 25th hearing, he'd already been told unequivocally he wasn't getting an attorney from the public defender's office and he wasn't getting an attorney from the trial court. Further, at that May 25th hearing, if you read the record, Mr. Smith tries to raise an issue of a writ of habeas corpus that he'd filed at the May 10th hearing, and that was about his right to counsel. He was trying to raise that issue, not very articulately, which is, of course, why he needed an attorney. So the May 25th hearing doesn't demonstrate that Mr. Smith had waived his right to counsel. It demonstrates that he understood from what he'd been told on May 10th that he wasn't getting counsel. In Patterson v. Illinois, the Supreme Court recognized, quote, the enormous importance and role that an attorney plays at the criminal stage, and imposed, quote, the most rigorous restrictions on the information that must be conveyed to a defendant and the procedures that must be observed. In this case, the trial court didn't follow any of that. It didn't advise Mr. Smith as to the dangers and disadvantages of self-representation. It was less than cursory in nature, and therefore Mr. Smith's decision to discharge Attorney Wilmoth cannot be deemed a knowing and intelligent waiver.
Thank you, Ms. Hanley. And you have the court's appreciation for taking this case by appointment. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.